Mr. Bradbury, I'd like to begin by talking with you about your wonderful book, The Martian Chronicles, which was published in 1950, and such a highly influential book with so many science fiction writers that I've spoken with, and even with planetary scientists. They say this book was such an important one for them in expressing the wonder of the prospects of colonizing Mars and of planetary exploration. Where did the ideas for the Martian Chronicles come from your boyhood or from your reading experience?
Oh, well, when I was 9 years old, I discovered Edgar Rice Burroughs, who wrote the Tarzan books and a whole series of books about the planet Mars. And in one of his novels about John Carter, Warlord of Mars, he ended the book on a note of questioning as to whether Dejah Thoris, the beautiful woman, was going to escape from a sun prison. And you had to wait a whole year for this circular prison to turn following the sun to bring the exit around to the entrance. So when I finished that book, I was frustrated, and I sat down and I wrote the sequel myself. That's the beginning of my career when I was 12 years old, and it's all on the planet Mars.
Wow, and so then at the age of 30, The Martian Chronicles ends up being published. Did you have a sense that that book was going to be the sensation that it was?
Oh, no, it didn't get any. It got only one review in the whole country. It got little obituary reviews in the back of magazines, and I was fortunate enough, though, that Christopher Isherwood bumped into me in a bookstore. And I seized a copy of the book and signed and gave it to him. And I could see from his face, he thought, oh, my God, one more book to read. So 3 days later, the phone rang, and it was Christopher Isherwood. And he said, Mr. Bradbury, do you know what you've done? I said, no, I don't think I know. He said, you've written a remarkable book, and I've just been made the book editor for reviewing books for the Tomorrow magazine, and yours is going to be my first review, and I'm going to do 1,200 words on it. And I said, oh, my God. And the review came out, and the analysis of the book, and it gave me an entrance into the intellectual world that I was not accepted there at that time. I went into bookstores, and the booksellers would run away from me because I was writing science fiction.
it was disreputable a genre at the time, huh?
Yeah, he made me respectable, and he introduced me to Gerald Hurd, the philosopher, and to Aldous Huxley, one of my great heroes. So I was in and running, but the book didn't sell well. The first year it sold around 5,000 copies, and every year after that for 10 or 20 years, it sold 2,000 copies hardcover, and when it came out in paperback, it sold around 50,000 or 100,000 a year, which is not a bestseller, but it's decent. But when you add that all up over a period of 40 years or so, you've got millions of readers, and the quality of many of the readers was quite wonderful. And I bumped into a lot of people now when I go to lectures. I said to the audience, when did you read me in high school? And half the hands in the audience go up. So thank God I wound up in the high schools.
That's got to be very gratifying.
Oh, it brings me to tears because I did not anticipate any of this.
Now, obviously, The Martian Chronicles, in addition to being a fantasy, it's also a work of social criticism, and I'm assuming that's what Christopher Isherwood was also addressing in his analysis
of the book. I think that's true, but again, it was all unconscious. The best writing is the writing you do without knowing quite what in hell you're doing. And if you're self-conscious, you begin to twist the truth in favor of the left or the right, or you're going to become a Freudian or a Jungian or a Scientologist or whatever. And when you do that, you're not doing good work.
Well, how important do you think it is, looking at the reality of space exploration, to take into account these kinds of social issues that are addressed in The Martian Chronicles as a part of the space program? Do you think that that's an important consideration?
No, I don't think so. The main problem we have is educating our president and educating our senators and our House of Representatives people, and in the history of legislation in Washington, there have been very few true believers. It's a shame, but there you have it. They're busy thinking about local problems and national problems, and they don't really think about space. So we have to educate them.
Are you a true believer as well as a storyteller?
Well, I wouldn't do what I do if I started believing all that when I was a kid, and it's never changed. I believe we belong on Mars. I believe we belong out in the universe, and I think we've missed our chance recently. Instead of staying on the moon, we came home and stayed here. The experiments we've carried out with the space shuttle are very fascinating. Some of them are quite wonderful, but nevertheless, it's earthbound, and we've got to go back to the moon and establish a colony there, and then as soon as possible, head off for Mars and establish a colony on Mars.
How does it make you feel to hear from planetary scientists and others who've worked with the space program who've said they got excited about the idea of planetary exploration through your work?
Oh, well, you know, I'm not a humble person, but it almost humbles me. it's wonderful. I met all the astronauts in Houston more than 30 years ago before the Apollo missions began. Life magazine had me down there to do interviews and do an article, and I was introduced to 70 different astronauts in the same room. None of them had names at the time. They got names later when the Apollo missions began to occur and we land on the moon. But I met all these sort of nameless, faceless people in a single room, and when I was introduced, I was sitting in the back of the room, half of the astronauts jumped to their feet and rushed back to me. Well, my God, you know, that was an incredible thing to know that all these young men were sons of mine. They were related to me by my work.
Let's talk about the Apollo 11 landing on the moon and the first walk on the moon. Do you remember where you were at that time? Is that a vivid recollection?
Yeah, it's too vivid. I was on the David Frost show in London. He invited me to come over to explain space travel because he was totally ignorant, and not only ignorant, a complete fool about it. He made fun of it on the air an hour before we landed. He insulted the British government and the head of the government about all this, and I stood there waiting to go on. It was almost 8:30 at night on Saturday. And we landed on the moon around 8:30 that night, and David Frost was supposed to introduce me to explain why I thought space travel was important, and he did this big wind-up about American genius, and I said, well, that's got to be me, right? And then he said, and here he is, Engelbert Humperdinck. Well, Humperdinck came up and sang his stupid song, and I walked off the show. And the producer ran after me, and he said, "Why? What are you doing?" I said, "I'm leaving." He said, "You can't do that." I said, "Watch my desk." I said, "That idiot in there doesn't know that this is the most important night in the history of mankind. We've been dreaming about going to the moon. We wanted to touch it. We wanted to live there. And now, after tens of thousands of years of dreaming and wanting and wishing, there we are, and my God, it's an important night, and he's ruined the whole thing, that stupid idiot in there. I said, let me go. So they let me go, they got me a taxi cab, and I went across London, and I did a show with Walter Cronkite, and I had a chance to speak the truths that I spoke about the immortality of man, that the traveling in space is going to ensure us a place in the universe 10,000 years from now, 100,000 years from now, and who knows, a million years from now, because we moved from the Earth to the Moon to Mars and on out toward Alpha Centauri.
How much do you think this is an instinct of humanity? Do we have a drive to explore the same way the earthbound explorers did in generations before ours? Is it a human compulsion?
Well, I think there's a thing inherent in mankind that we're developing still. We're very young. I've written an essay recently called Too Soon from the Cave, Too Far from the Stars. We've only been out of the cave for a few thousand years, and we're a long way from the stars. So we're in transit. If you read George Bernard Shaw, he spoke of mankind and the history of our movement out of the caves into the cities and expanding across the universe at some time or another. We have a drive, a compulsion indeed, or we wouldn't have done it. Kennedy would not have announced our desire to go to the moon. Part of it was competition with Russia, of course, but the rest is the adventurous spirit of mankind ever moving outward and onward.
And which do you think are the most important reasons why we should explore the planets in space? Is it that human instinct for adventure and exploration?
No, is it
the future need to colonize?
No. We want to live forever, and that's what it's all about. If we stay on Earth, eventually the sun will die or the sun will explode. We'll either freeze to death or we'll be burned to death. So that being true, we have to move out through the universe as a witness to the miraculous, you know. I did a program for the space people 2 years ago in Pasadena called Witness and Celebrate. The function of mankind is to look at the miraculous and to celebrate it. And space travel gives us a chance not only to adventure, but to celebrate the very fact of our being alive in the universe. We are completely impossible, but here we are. We haven't the faintest idea of how life began on the Earth. We just know that it did, and we have no scientific explanation for it. So with that as truth in our past, we have to look to the future and move out and away from this planet, where not only is the environment dangerous to us, just the natural environment, but we are in danger of hurting ourselves. Right at this very moment, there are dozens of wars being waged all over the Earth. We cannot seem to chain the tribal instincts in us that cause us to destroy one another. That being true, we have to use space travel as a substitute for war. There's a thing in mankind that loves to make war, that loves to destroy, loves to be brutal, but we have to substitute space travel for that problem.
Mr. Bradbury, I appreciate your being with us so much and talking with us. Our mutual friend Lou Friedman of the Planetary Society had run requests, since this is a documentary for them. He asked if you would be so kind as to read the passage from the Martian Chronicles, "We Are the Martians." Would you be able to read that for us?
Well, I can quote from my encounter there.
Okay.
In Pasadena, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, that would be great.
I was there the night we landed on Mars with the Viking lander, and the first photographs came back from Mars around 6 in the morning, and line by line, I saw them reproduced on the screen, and by 9 o'clock, we had our first pictures of Mars. And Roy Neal of NBC interviewed me on TV and radio that morning, and he dared to say, "Mr. Bradbury, how does it feel now that you've been writing about Mars all these years and you put a civilization up there with Martians and you colonized it with all kinds of people? And how does it feel now that we've landed there and you discover there is no civilization, there are no cities, and there are no Martians?" And I said, fool, there are Martians on Mars, and it is us. We are the Martians. From this day forward, we Earthmen have become Martians, and we will live there, and we will survive there. Now, no more questions like that. And that's how I answered it.
What a wonderful way for us to conclude. Thank you so much, Mr. Bradbury.